Our teaching series during these weeks of Lent, the name that we give the time leading up to Easter, is focused around the very last week of Jesus' life, as Peace told us earlier on. Each week we're learning about a particular day in Jesus' final week that ended up with his crucifixion on Good Friday. The four Gospels recount all of this in considerable detail, taking as much as 40% of their material to talk about this last week and these final few days. The significance that they give, sheer in the volume of their writing, helps us to pause and ponder what's actually going on here. We look at a different day. Last weekend, we were at Sunday, the Sunday that sometimes we call Palm Sunday, when Jesus entered into Jerusalem riding on a donkey, and I can't resist the moment to use my accent to its full potential here. Donkey! See? Anyway, that's got nothing to do with Shrek. But Sunday we called Palm Sunday. Jesus arrived in Jerusalem. Focus, people, please. It's hard enough for me to focus. What kind of a king is Jesus is the question we were asking. And today we're going to look at the events that happened in the Monday of that week. Jesus rode into Jerusalem. The guys, they all hung around for a while. They went away to spend the night in a little village called Bethany. It's about 3.5 kilometers away, and they stayed there. And we're going to pick up the story the very next morning in Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 11, beginning at verse 12. This is what we read. The next day as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the fig tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard him say it. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, "Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you've made it a den of robbers?" The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him, because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. Now, you have to be honest, at least I want to be. This doesn't exactly seem like Jesus' finest moment. Really, normally he's being nice, not so much here. What's he doing picking on a tree? What did the tree ever do to him? Had he ever met it before? We've all had a bad day, and we've all said or done things that we sometimes regret, and we know what that would feel like. Is that just Jesus? He's having a bad morning, and he's taking it out on this tree, perhaps. After all, the first verse that we read in verse 12 says that Jesus was hungry, and what's the word we use for hungry, angry people? Hangry. Is that Jesus? Is that what? He stayed the night in Bethany. I guess he had bed, but no breakfast. They maybe could have upgraded their accommodation. Or maybe because they had such a big party, the triumphal entry, the palm trees, all this sort of stuff. They stayed up partying way too late at night. Everybody slept in. When they got up, breakfast was over. Sorry, you're too late. Regardless, Jesus is having a bad day, and this tree's going to have a worse day. Fig trees were a significant source of domesticated fruit in Bible times in the Middle East. They still are. They grow well in moderately dry areas that have little rain as the fruit matures. You enjoy figs. I've tried one, I'm sure. But there was none on this tree. Nothing. No fruit. Nothing but leaves. The tree had fully mature leaves, every appearance of the promise of fruit, but there was nothing but leaves. Now, Jesus knew as well as anybody else it wasn't the season for figs. It's too early. The fruit only comes later in the spring, which makes this sound really weird to me. If the expectation of finding fruit is kind of out of place, what's Jesus doing? This seems somewhat petulant or selfish. Is he just getting upset over nothing? What's up, Jesus? And then to think, he actually uses his divine power in a destructive way. Every other story you read about Jesus, every other miracle, every other thing he did, seems to be fairly kind in what's going on, helping people, healing people, calming storms, helping people get on their way, looking after those in the margins of life. Here, Jesus is just using some kind of divine power to fry a tree. Like, what's that about? What's he doing? It compounds the behavior. Unless perhaps this strange behavior forces us to look into our Bibles a little more carefully and figure out what's going on. Fig trees were often used in the Old Testament, the first part of our Bible written in Hebrew, to describe or stand as a metaphor for the people of Israel. For instance, you could look at God's words through the prophet Hosea when God says this, "When I found Israel, it was like finding grapes in the desert. When I saw your ancestors, it was like seeing the early fruit in the fig tree." The figs represent the people, God's people. And if God's people were unfaithful to him, well, the word picture continued to work for them, because if they were unfaithful, the word picture meant they were also unfruitful. Listen to these words to the prophet Jeremiah. He says this, "I will take away their harvest, declares the Lord. There will be no grapes in the vine. There will be no figs on the tree, and their leaves will wither. What I have given them will be taken from them." So maybe Jesus isn't just ticked off that he didn't get his breakfast. Perhaps he's acting out a parable, an image, something for people to grasp hold of about their own lives. Jesus has arrived, not just at a tree. Jesus has arrived to his people Israel, and they're not ready. In fact, they're not fruitful. That's perhaps what's going on here. In fact, John's gospel would put it like this in chapter 1. "The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world. And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him." In other words, this picture of the fig tree, of people not being ready, of people living unfruitful lives, it's a picture of impending judgment. There's another reason, though, why I think we need to look for a deeper meaning in the story of the fig tree. It's not just that it represents Israel, it's the way Mark tends to write. He often uses a technique that scholars will call intercalation. That sounds really complicated, and it's not particularly. It's easier to think of a sandwich. Call it a Mark sandwich. There's a slice of bread, there's some sort of cheese or cold cut in the middle, there's another slice of bread, and he makes a sandwich out of it. That's how he writes. Something happens, something else happens, something happens. Take this for instance. In the fig tree shows up in verses 12 through 14. The next incident is the temple in verses 15 through 19. And then in verses 20 and 21, which happens the next day, tomorrow, we'll think about that next weekend, we're back at the fig tree again. It's a sandwich, figs, temple, figs. I mean, Sterling could start selling this sort of stuff in Cornerstone. You could all be buying fig sandwiches and we could call it the Mark sandwich. Okay, you're not interested, that's fine. He thought it was a good idea, I thought it was a good idea. The incident with the fig tree is this picture of impending judgment, and we see it immediately acted out when we get to the temple with Jesus. The first temple in Jerusalem was built a long time ago by King Solomon. In fact, it was destroyed in 587 BC when the Babylonian Empire was sweeping through the Middle East and took over the nation of Judah and destroyed their temple and took people into exile. Kind of what you see happening in countries today. There's this forced movement of people taken into exile, genocide, all sorts of struggles going on. Eventually, a second temple was built by a guy with a fantastic name, Zerubbabel. And exiles who returned from Babylonia and came back to Jerusalem, and they built a temple around 538 BC. It wasn't huge. And actually, it was expanded significantly by King Herod in Jesus' time. Herod had delusions of grandeur, and he built these immense retaining walls so he could have a bigger platform on the Temple Mount and built bridges that would make it easy to get in and out of the city. And if you've ever been to Jerusalem or wanted to look at some photos online or use Google Street View, you can still see the immense retaining walls and some of the bridge work that was done. It didn't get finished by the time Herod died. In fact, they barely got finished before AD 70, when the Romans, who had taken control of Israel, actually destroyed the temple that was there. The buildings were made out of this magnificent limestone that glistened in the sun. It was spectacular to see. It would have been a magnificent sight. But when Jesus shows up, he's not impressed. In fact, Jesus ends up having what I like to call a temple tantrum. He's just upset. I know, it's a dad joke, but just bear with me, okay? Let's just keep going here. The fig tree, the incident in the temple, they're related. It's a picture of judgment too. And Jesus has six things going on here that seem kind of crazy. The salespeople are driven out. Now, they're not bad people. Sometimes we think they're terrible people ripping others off, but they were selling the things that were needed for temple worship. You need an unblemished animal to sacrifice. You could do with some flour or oil or water. They were selling the things that you actually needed to get into the worship event with. They were thrown out. And then the customers, those who were buying the things, they were also chucked out as well. No more worship today, because if you didn't have your stuff, you couldn't worship. Just go home. And then the money changers had their tables turned. Everybody round about then had to pay what they called a temple tax. We get that. You get carbon tax and GST and all sorts of taxes. They had temple tax, and they had to pay it in a specific coin. They called it the Tyrian half shekel. You had to go to the temple to get one. It was kind of like going to the mall to Calpherex to exchange your currency. That's what's going on here. And Jesus tosses them all out. They're gone too. And then we read that Jesus overturned the tables of people that were selling doves. And I wonder about that. You see, doves were sacrifices for poor people. If you couldn't afford a lamb or whatever else was required, you could afford a dove perhaps, and that's what people would use. And we know Jesus' family was dirt poor. When Jesus was born and he was taken to the temple for dedication, if you read the stories, that's all his mom and dad could afford. Mary and Joseph could afford a dove. They didn't have the money for anything else. And I'm thinking, Jesus, your own parents, at least give them a chance, man. How could you be so unkind and not even let the poor people come and worship? And then he stops everybody carrying stuff in the temple courts. Just leave. And finally, he explains himself, quoting a couple of Bible verses. What's it all about? Well, it's certainly not a takeover of the temple. I mean, he didn't throw the priests out. He didn't really take charge or install himself as the high priest. It wasn't a takeover. He wasn't starting a religious or a political revolution, I don't think. Because the way of violence is never the way of Jesus. And we need to always remind ourselves of that in the situations that we find our world in. The way of Jesus is never the way of violence. It wasn't revolution. You know what? It wasn't even really a reform of what was going on there. He wasn't getting a new way of doing things with a big placard on the wall. No more of this. Just do these six things. It'll all be great. He didn't do that. He did interrupt operations that day. He did interrupt worship that day. He pressed the pause button. Nobody could do anything much more. Everybody needed to go home on that first day, Monday. There was nothing for them to do. So how did Jesus explain himself then? If it's not a revolution, it's not a reformation, what's he actually doing? What does it all mean? Verse 17, Jesus taught them and he said this, "Is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you've made it into a den of robbers." He's actually quoting the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah says this, God's voice, "These I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." And Isaiah's expanding upon and talking about this image that one day all of the nations of the world will come to worship God in Jerusalem, in Mount Zion, in his temple. It had always been God's plan. And if you want to see Isaiah's magnificent vision of this, here's a bit of homework for you today. Take 15 minutes and read Isaiah chapter 60 sometime today. It is this stunning word picture of what God has promised will come in the age of the Messiah towards the end of time. In fact, it's always been God's desire. Even when King Solomon built and dedicated the very first temple, we read about God's words, and rather Solomon's words to God in 1 Kings chapter 8. And Solomon prays this, "As for the foreigner who does not belong to your people, Israel, but has come from a distant land because of your name, for they'll hear of your great fame and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm. And when they come and pray toward this temple, then hear from heaven, your dwelling place, do whatever the foreigner asks of you, so that all peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your own people Israel. And may they know this house that I have built bears your name." And here's Jesus. He's in the court of the Gentiles, the place where foreigners could come to worship, the specific place that was set aside for those who weren't from Israel to worship God. And he's reminding everybody that God is calling everyone to himself. There's no place in faith for nationalism or racism. Now, it's not that foreigners weren't welcome in Jesus' time, but with all this ancillary activity that seemed to be going on, space was limited. And Jesus is bringing in this new age, the age of the Messiah, that will remind us that the time has come. God's great invitation to all people to come and worship. It's here and now. We don't need to wait any longer. The commission that Jesus would give to his disciples to go into all the world and proclaim the good news, to teach and baptize. It's here. It's now. It's why we send international workers. It's why we partner to help those in Poland that are serving refugees from Ukraine. It's why we have become a multi-ethnic church. It's why we will launch a Spanish congregation this fall at FAC, because God is calling all people to himself. And right here in this incident in the temple, Jesus is changing everybody's focus. He's changing it to an outward focus. One scholar, a man called Eckhart Schnabel, he said this: Jesus' action in the outer court of the temple was a symbolic action that seems to focus not so much on the location where Gentiles were worshipped, the temple in Jerusalem, as on the reality of an entirely new kind of worship, which will be neither sacrificial animals nor money changers for the temple tax. They won't be needed. We learned about this actually in our Hebrews series when we were reading through Hebrews together. Do you remember these words in chapter 9? But when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle or temple that's not made with human hands. That is to say, is not part of this creation. He didn't enter by means of bloods or goats of calves, the stuff that you could buy there. He entered the most holy place once and for all, by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. You know what we're discovering here? We're reading that the old sacrificial system is now redundant. It had functioned well as a signpost pointing toward Jesus. Everybody knew they needed something to reconcile them to God. And here's Jesus saying, the old is gone, the new has come. Something new is here. We don't need the temple because we have Jesus. That's what he's reminding us. We don't need the temple. We have Jesus. And Jesus is sending us with this good news. He's sending you with good news. And maybe we need to ask ourselves today, who is Jesus sending me to? Who is he sending me to? It's a question that all of us need to answer for ourselves. Who is Jesus sending you to? Jesus refers to his temple as a house of prayer. But he also says it's been turned into a den of robbers. That's a quotation, this time the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah says this in chapter 7, God's words, has this house, which bears my name, become a den of robbers to you? But I've been watching, declares the Lord. You've got to wonder, is it just a reference to the commercial activity, kind of like the movies, $5 for a pop, $7 for your popcorn? It's a complete ripoff, but what do? You pay for the convenience. Is that what is going on? Just daylight robbery of poor people coming to worship God? But daylight robbery doesn't usually happen in the robber's den. That's where the guys go when they've ripped you off or when they've scammed you in some fake thing in your email. That's where they go and hide. Could it be that Jesus is referring to the religious leaders as the robbers and they're the ones hiding in the temple, hiding behind the sacrifices? In a sense, seeking sanctuary from God's wrath. The prophet Jeremiah also says this: will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal and follow other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which bears my name, and say, we're safe. Safe to do all these detestable things? Could it be that through Jesus, God is telling them, you can't hide any longer. You can run, but you can't hide. After all, on the Tuesday of the final week, we read this conversation. As Jesus is leaving the temple, one of his disciples says to him, look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings. Do you see all these great buildings? Replied Jesus. Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. The temple would be destroyed. There would be nowhere to hide. AD 70, it would happen as the Roman general would march in. It would be destroyed. And Jesus' action in the temple, that day, if you like, a little earthquake of tables being turned, shaking up the routine. It was a living parable, acting out the prophecy of God's destruction of the temple to come. Maybe a couple of little phrases that we sometimes use would help us. You could say something like this: God has left the building. Not Elvis, God, get it right. But without its divine occupant, it was only a matter of time before the roof would cave in and the walls would fall over. God had left the building. And those that are trying to prop up the old way or clean it up or reform it somehow, it's not going to work because King Jesus has shown up. He's come to the rescue and he is building a brand new sanctuary. He doesn't need that one anymore. Or you could try this phrase, out with the old and in with the new. Ah, the old is gone, including the old temple. It's going to be done. There's going to be something new. Jesus said this, I tell you that something greater than the temple is here. The fig tree is this picture of impending judgment in God's people who have been unfaithful and unfruitful. And Jesus' action in the temple is talking about the way we try to hide from God and mask ourselves. But where does that leave us? What does all this stuff, interesting as it may be, on the Monday of the final week have to do for us? The Apostle Paul writes to his friends in a little city called Corinth in Greece, and he says this to them, do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You're not your own. You were bought with a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. There's a new temple these days, and it's us, the followers of Jesus. And yet sometimes I think we get that all kind of mixed up. Sometimes we think that we're being a little bit more like Jesus when we get angry about everything and everyone. We get angry about what's going on in church. After all, we're the temple of the Lord. Somebody sees something's wrong, I'll get the Jesus stuff out, get a whip, get a few people beaten into shape. It's going to be fine. And we end up with a sort of self-appointed messianic complex, cracking the whip, running people out. Maybe sometimes it is needed. But it seems to me we're a whole lot more ready to do that than to do something else. Pick up a cross, deny yourself, consider the needs and well-being of someone else more important than your own, stepping up to serve others. There's not always quite so many takers at that point. And even if that's not us, we're not trying to be self-righteous and tell everybody else what to do, pointing out their flaws. It is easy to get it wrong. It's easy for us to get it wrong. And so maybe today is a good day for each one of us to examine our own lives. It's a good day to examine our own lives. Could it be that we're so busy with religious activity, we lose sight of our calling? Could it be that we who claim to follow Jesus or just the entirety of our lives are so busy? We lose sight of Jesus. Our demands for freedom obscure the call to follow the one who gave everything. Might it be that when we gather in person or online to worship and sing and pray and listen and read, but nothing actually ever changes in our lives? And just like the fig tree, there's nothing but leaves. Within the temple, there was all this activity of religion, all the appearance of a mature and well-developed faith. But if we play with the metaphors a little bit, all that religious stuff was nothing but leaves. Hypocrisy, the deceptive appearance of faithfulness and fruitfulness, but there was no fruit. And for all of its busy life, the temple was corrupt. There was nothing but leaves. Appearances can be deceiving, I think, even for us today. There's lots of nice people around church who look full of faith and Bible and vibrant in what they're doing. But in reality, when we look at ourselves closely, we know that we are nothing but leaves. We have tidy Christian lives. We have well-packaged, pre-planned answers to every single question. Little Jesus smiles. But you're nothing but leaves. The appearance of fruitfulness that awakens the expectation of fruit, but it's only a pretense. Nothing but leaves. Is that us? Is that you? It happens so easily. We permit grudges to grow in our heart, and all the religious activity in the world won't change it. When greed and envy and malice and hate begin to get a grip in our lives, they're hung up on the walls of our soul. You can't paper over that very easily. When we turn our backs on the needs of others who experience homelessness or don't have enough food to eat or are fleeing desperate for their lives and we go, it's not my problem. We're just nothing but leaves. What would happen if Jesus was to come along and inspect our temple? I don't mean the building, I mean you, me. Or change the metaphor to the tree, have a look at us. What would he find? After all, if we're supposed to be like the fig tree, our lives are supposed to be fruitful. And what does fruit look like for us? Well, we hear about it when we read Paul talk of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Fruit certainly looks like disciples who are discipling other people. Disciples making more disciples. And if we're not discipling someone, if you are not discipling someone, then explain to me how your life is fruitful. Whose life do you pour into right now? What are you doing? At FEC, we simply call it building lives that honor God. Whose life are you building into? Who are you giving yourself to? Who are you discipling? Maybe it's a good day after all to examine your own life before Jesus comes to inspect. It's also a good day, I think, for us to examine our prayer lives. Is prayer a priority? Do we give up too easily? Jesus was telling his friends a parable one day to show them, we read in Luke 18, that they should always pray and not give up. Don't give up. It's hard to give up. It's easy to give up, sorry. At least it is for me. It's easy sometimes with difficult things to feel God isn't listening. The things of my life, the things in my family's life, is God really listening? You just want to give up trying, talking to the ceiling. But instead of quitting, maybe perhaps we could get honest and we could cry out to Lord, how long, oh Lord, how long? I'm tired of this. He won't get angry with you. He never gets mad just because you're shouting. He longs for us to have a conversation with him, and he won't mind that you get honest and get real and express how you really feel, because you have no idea how much God wants to hear from you today. And we've a great opportunity to help each other. I know some of us find it hard to pray. I find it hard to pray sometimes. I get that. It's why we don't want to guilt each other, but help each other. It's why we've got this beautiful prayer retreat coming up on April 2. And if prayer is one of those difficult areas of your life and you feel it's easier to give up than keep going, you don't need to be ashamed. We come to learn and support each other, to help each other, to pray for each other. And the challenges that are my life, that are far too obvious to many of you, I'm so grateful for my personal prayer team that pray with me and for me every Thursday morning. And even when I can't be there because I'm traveling, they still meet and pray for me. I'm so grateful for our lead team who faithfully pray for me and hold me up when I feel so very broken in my own life. I'm grateful for my small group who pray for me. I'm grateful for my dear friends who know all of the truth about me and they love me anyway and still pray for me. Who's praying for you? And who are you praying for? Might be a good day to examine your own prayer life. It's also a good day for us to choose to say yes to Jesus. A great day to surrender, to hand over our lives to him. I love the words in Romans chapter 10 that Paul writes when he says, if you declare with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved, because everyone who calls in the name of the Lord will be saved. Is there space today in your life for Jesus? Is there some uncrowded, uncluttered space for him in the holy center of your life where he can speak and begin to shape and change you? Would you like to become more fruitful in your own life? It could be you today. In a moment or two, we're going to witness a number of baptisms. We had 3 baptisms on Wednesday evening at a student ministry service and 7 baptisms last night here in the Deerfoot campus. It's an exciting weekend for us. We're going to watch some more of lives that are changed now and forever. And as you witness people go under the water and be raised from the water, you know the old has gone and the new has come in their lives. And that could be you. God could change your life. The people that we'll witness being baptized, they all have different stories, but they've all come to discover that Jesus can change absolutely everything. Today's a good day to say yes to Jesus, because God, through Jesus, offers to make something beautiful out of your brokenness. Jesus offers a better story to your life, a better ending to the story than the one that you've been busy writing for the past few years. Jesus offers rest from our endless efforts to try and find significance in this world. He offers us identity that's got nothing to do with our poor performance at times. He offers radical inclusion to those who easily feel excluded or live in the margins of society. He offers to create value from parts of our life that we think or others tell us are just worthless. He embraces mystery with us in a world that craves false certainties. He offers us something to live for that's far greater than just me and my little life. He offers us work that is meaningful and retains value for all eternity. He offers us freedom where we don't have to hide behind masks. And I don't mean medical masks. I mean our false pretense. We don't need to do it. He offers us freedom. He offers justice and equality and restoration for those who are suffering. He offers reconciliation and healing for those whose relationships are beyond repair. He offers the renewal to things that are old and resurrection to things that are dead. Jesus offers freedom to those of us caught in addiction. Jesus models excellence in our world of fakes and cheap knockoffs. Jesus offers peace in our world of chaos and strife. It's a good day to say yes to Jesus. And maybe never have. They hang around church. Or maybe you don't even do that often. But here you are, in a room or watching at home, in a church service, perhaps beginning to understand there is a little bit more to life than what I'm experiencing right now. Understanding that something needs to change and I can't, but Jesus can. Discovering there's a better way and a better story for our lives. Maybe today you're tired of a life that's just leaves. It's a great day to say yes to Jesus. Would you pray with me? Father, thank you that Jesus came not just to tear down, but to build and to renew and to resurrect and to make everything brand new again. It's a story we're going to see in a minute of people who are being baptized. And Lord, we pray for them that they would sense your great pleasure in their lives and your Spirit filling them anew. And it's a moment for us to pray for ourselves, because sometimes we just feel like leaves. There's not much substance about us. And sometimes we feel a long way away, or perhaps we've never really encountered Jesus before. And today we're simply saying, Jesus, we need you. And we need something to change. And I choose to surrender control of my life to you. I invite you to do for me what you've obviously done for these people that I'm going to watch in a moment or two. Would you change my life and make me brand new? Rewrite my story and give me that different ending. May my life be fruitful and valuable and worth something in your eyes. I offer myself to you now completely in Jesus' name. Amen. We're going to watch these baptisms. We do more than watch. We participate. Make sure they know how much you love them and support them and pray for them.